Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, we are back in our spiritual home, the Putney Exchange Centre, as you can probably tell from the coffee machine that is whirring in the background. Hope you'll put up with the little sound effects, because it all makes it part of it, doesn't it? However, we are joined by some very special guests today. As per usual, we have Catherine Whittaker. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. Four of us to drown out the sound of espresso being made.
A handsome quartet we have here, joined by Matt Roberts. Hello, Matt.
Hello, David.
Hello, and we've got, making his Putney Exchange debut, it's the Telegraph's Simon Briggs.
Greetings. Yes, I didn't realise what a fine view of Waitrose you guys have when you record this podcast.
Yes, we do have a lovely view of said supermarket.
Well, Catherine and I have a view of the Loo's currently.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've got the better side of the table.
Okay. Right. Well, we've got lots to talk about. So enough supermarkets and toilets. We've got plenty of tennis matters to discuss. A few results, a few plot lines within the actual confines of the court. We'll get to that later. But really, what we're here to do today is to discuss politics, hence the arrival of Simon Briggs to the Putney Exchange. And one of the main...
The Nick Robinson of tennis.
Yes, the main reason
for
that...
Beat me, Nora Koonsberg.
All right.
Update your references.
The main reason for that is because about an hour after we published last week's podcast, great timing, folks, Simon Briggs tweeted that some news was incoming from an LA courtroom, correct?
That was when you were recording the last one.
Yes, that's right.
That was from Josh Boswell, our excellent man on the spot.
Yeah, yeah. And the news was that Justin Gilmerstob, who, for those of you that follow tennis loosely but don't really, you might have heard the name Justin Gilmerstob, you might have heard there's a bit of furore about him, and he does a lot of things within tennis. He is an ATP board player representative, one of the three, making big decisions, including which one of them was to vote on Chris Kermode, the ATP CEO, not having his contract renewed at the end of the year. He and David Egdes and Alex Inglot are the three player representatives on the ATP board. He's also a commentator for Tennis Channel in the US, and he is a former player. He's also the coach of John Isner. So those are a few of his hats.
Player agent, I believe, as well.
Is he?
Yeah, and owner of a production company.
Yes, about to say, produced to ATP Uncovered since 2013.
Yeah, so he has a lot of hats within tennis.
Fingers
as Justin
in pies.
Gilmerstob. Now, we told you around the Australian Open that he was charged and arrested having been involved in an assault of somebody that he'd known for a long time, a man called Randall Kaplan, a friend of his wife, who he's currently in divorce proceedings with. And at that time, it was ongoing. There was a hearing. It looked as though it was going to go to trial. At the time, all the players decided that they would keep him in position. They voted to do so. However, in this hearing of last week, he was charged with felony battery by the Los Angeles District Attorney, but avoided trial by offering a no-contest plea. He was sentenced to 3 years probation, 60 days community service, and a year of anger management therapy after being convicted of beating Randall Kaplan more than 50 times and threatening to kill him in front of his wife and two-year-old child on Halloween. These are the charges. The judge explained to Gilmerstob, and Gilmerstob accepted, that his no-contest plea is effectively the same as pleading guilty to a felony. The judge said that Gimelstob's attack was considered unprovoked, and the court heard some pretty harrowing witness statements both from Randall Kaplan himself and from his wife Madison, who alleged that she said that she had a miscarriage shortly afterwards, and she put it down to that incident as the reason for it. He said that Randall Kaplan said it was beyond terrifying. I've never been so scared in my entire life. If nobody had stopped him and if he had continued beating my head like he wanted to, I may not be here today. I could be dead. Throughout the statements from his two victims, Gimelstob sat 5 feet away, shook his head and said no, and that didn't happen, and he was admonished by the judge, Yupinder Kalra, for failing to control himself. He was also warned by the judge that if he made any statements to the media claiming he was not guilty, his misdemeanor deal could be revoked. And that's important to say as well, that the felony charge was reduced to a misdemeanor, albeit the judge said, look, just so that you know, you are pleading guilty to a felony here by accepting this no contest plea, or by pleading no contest. And he nodded his head and said okay. He is now filing for a restraining order, Justin Gimelstob, and
against Randall Kaplan.
And
I believe that's been rejected.
Right. And he also gave an interview to the New York Times.
The interview happened, as far as I understand it, before the court verdict was handed down, although it could be argued that he endorsed it by tweeting the link after the verdict.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that was something Catherine and I were discussing, the timing of the interview given. But as you said, Catherine, to me, the fact is he then tweeted the link of that article, which included some, I felt, pretty astonishing quotes about his expectation or hope that he would be able to redeem himself or come back and be part of the ATB setup in the future and not lose his position going forward.
He also delineated what he saw as the provocation for his attack and said, I didn't do what he said, and talked about extenuating circumstances, which could very easily be seen as a violation of the judge's orders.
Which he also made in his application for a restraining order. He detailed, that happened after the verdict, he detailed the fact that he's claiming that Randall Kaplan had been critical or unpleasant about his father, who had died shortly before the attack. So, yeah, that's where we are. I mean, the guy is a big figure. That's the first thing to say. I mean, a lot of people might not actually be familiar with, as you say, who he is, but you could argue he's been the most powerful player in ATP politics over the last year. Certainly, he seemed to win in what was effectively a head-to-head showdown between his camp and Chris Kermode's camp at the vote in Indian Wells. He had the support of David Egdes, who is his old friend and fellow Tennis Channel executive, or employee perhaps I should say, who is on the ATP board. He had the support of Alex Inglot, another player representative on the board. That's all three player representatives on the board who voted not to extend Chris Kermode's contract in March, in what has been described as a backroom coup, because they seem to want to keep it pretty quiet. And they put out a statement afterwards saying, we're surprised that there's so much interest in this. You know, we're taking out the most visible figurehead of the men's tour in a sport which is played by people like Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. You know, anyway, so he's a big figure. That's the first point to make, because I'm not sure everyone is familiar until recent weeks as to what exactly his role in the sport was.
Yeah, he's a major decision maker, and the conversation that has moved on since then, and obviously he is going to have to serve his probation period and his 60 days community service. The question mark is now, he stood down himself from Tennis Channel at the time when the charges were first brought, for breathing space as much as anything, but no suggestion that that was permanent. He did not stand down from his position on the ATP board.
Rather, he stood up yeah, and waved his hand and made things happen in a way which has caused significant upset within the ATP and the sport generally.
And as things stand, Tennis Channel have released a statement which, I think in your words, Simon, was a bit of a shrug from them, which is a kind of so what, and they said that they would be speaking to him. They're sure that he's glad that it's over now, or that the situation has been resolved, and that they would talk to him and consider their position. At this point, they haven't released any position on him at all, and neither have the ATP board or player council officially. A number of the player council members have been asked and given some quotes. One of them, Vasek Pospisil, incidentally, initially released some quotes to Stephanie Miles of Tennis Life and said, amongst other things, I don't know the details of the case, but that he's done a great job for the players and we would be fortunate to have him serve another term in the future. Now, I was shocked by that, and got in touch with him and asked him to explain himself, and actually he admitted he hadn't read the details of the case. He has since read them. He said all the player council now have 10 members of the players that represent the wider body of players, with Novak Djokovic as the president of that player council. And Vasek Pospisil did make it clear that he did not condone violence, etc., but that he'd made those comments in haste in order to get a statement out because he'd been asked for one, and it's quite clear he regrets making that statement without having properly considered all the details of it and read all those witness statements. So he's now done that. He said that they will go away. There is an election, a vote now on May the 14th to decide whether Justin Gimelstob will stay on the board, and that was the case anyway, wasn't it?
That has nothing to do with any of this, and indeed if he was to be turned down at that vote in a normal ongoing process that would happen in any case, then he would still continue until the end of 2019, which is also the position with Chris Komode, president of the ATP, that he will continue until the end of 2019. So that's almost a sort of beside the point, in the sense of there will need to be some decisions made. You mentioned the Tennis Channel haven't actually released any decision. They put out the statement in which the first sentence was, "We are sure Justin is pleased to have resolved this matter," which seemed to me to be significantly insensitive to the feelings of the people on the other side of the attack. Then the ATP board could potentially remove him on the grounds that he brought the tour into disrepute, but that would need a unanimous verdict from the other five board members, who include David Egdes, his close friend and associate, and Alex Inglot, who's voted with him so far. Or he could be removed by the player council, who did this same manoeuvre with Roger Rashid at the end of 2017, is it? No, the end of 2018, sorry. There's just so much of this saga to keep straight in my head. 2018, at the end of 2018, they removed Roger Rashid for, in the view of the player council, not following their instructions on a new pay deal with the tournaments. On that ground, they could still vote to remove Gimelstob from his position, and then May 14 would become irrelevant.
Mm. So since then, I mean, a week has passed. Initially, it felt to me as though, yes, there were some people, of whom I'd include myself, immediately had the view that, well, this guy needs to step down from his position, or he needs to be removed, because the sport should not be led by somebody who has this against their name. I think it's a terrible look for tennis. I'll talk more about that. I mean, I'm amazed that he didn't stand down, or wasn't asked to stand down pending the results of this. I understand why he didn't, and why the players came out in numbers at the time during the Australian Open and said, look, innocent until proven guilty, was their view. I do have some understanding and respect for that vantage point. I don't agree with it, but that's what a lot of them thought. Now, over the course of the past week, people have just dripped out one by one and started to read these details and become more and more critical of the fact that he is still in position. I mean, if I go,
some people have.
There's a lot of them now, though. If you think about it,
notable exceptions, though.
Notable exceptions, but I think one of the first people that I heard starting to change her view was Martina Navratilova, who initially, and she's a colleague of Justine Gimelstob on the Tennis Channel, and she, you could understand why it was a difficult position for her in that regard, but she said, look, they will decide what to do, but I am sad to say this, and say this I must, Justin would not get my vote, not anymore. Other people have since commented on the situation. Darren Cahill said Justin should have stepped down from the board months ago pending the result of his legal case. Now that the judgment is in, the player council should pick another candidate to represent men's tennis at board level. If contrary information is revealed in his civil case, then I'd welcome Justin to run for a board position again if he so wishes. He also adds there's good in Justin that many people don't get to see, but clearly what happened is unacceptable on many levels. Amelia Mesmo said, I guess that's not the kind of behaviour you want to see from someone in our sport, having a big role in any of the ATP, WTA or ITF, definitely not. And the big one was Andy Murray speaking to Simon in the Telegraph, and Andy Murray coming out and saying, I don't see how, with everything that has gone on, how it's possible for him to remain in a position of authority or management at the ATP right now. Those are quite big words from a significant player, given that his fellow, let's say, Big Four members, we haven't heard from two of them at all. In Roger Federer hasn't been in a position to be asked, certainly in a press conference. Novak Djokovic hasn't played a tournament since then. He's also the head of the player council, so there's a sort of wider role that he has to play. Rafael Nadal was asked in Barcelona. He said, I will give my opinions to the player council if I'm asked. He was asked, what are those opinions? He said, I don't want to tell you. So that was that's what Rafael Nadal had to say.
Well, he said he wanted to speak to the player council first, didn't he? I suspect we may hear what he thinks in Madrid.
Yeah. Why did he need to speak to the player council to form his own view of the situation?
Well, I don't think he does. I think he has his view. I wonder whether actually after Australia, when he did come out and say what he thought about the Chris Kermode situation, was kind of admonished by Novak Djokovic a little bit as to say, well, you could have come and found me.
There was a to and fro about that, wasn't there?
There was. I wonder whether he thinks actually what I should do is tell the people making the decisions rather than talk to the press and then hear about it from them. I wonder whether he feels that, which I could kind of understand. I would personally prefer... I think they just need to get on with it and tell us what they think, like Andy Murray has done.
Bigger than an internal dispute now.
I think what Andy, for me, all the way through the last few years has shown is his unusual ability to actually see tennis from a broader perspective, which very few of the others have. You know, athletes are, by very nature, very selfish. They live in a bubble. They have to. They have to try and compete and focus on the court. And Andy has been unusual in his ability to see big pictures, and some of the other players resent him for the things he's said in defence of equal pay and his sort of feminist stance. So it wasn't a surprise to me that he was the first to comment on this. I did reach out to Novak Djokovic's press wing, if you like, to say, you know, is there any way we can sort of discuss what his stance might be, or off the record even, and didn't have any joy with that. So I suppose, you know, he's going to come into the press room in Madrid, and that will be interesting as well.
Yeah, it certainly will. Well, what are all of our views on the situation as things stand? What's your view, Simon?
I don't think he will stand for election on May the 14th. Maybe I'm an optimist, but I feel that the board... And I don't mean he'll step down voluntarily, but I think that either the board or the player council will make a stand. I do actually think that will happen, but I've been optimistic before. I mean, I think that's the right thing, and I've been proved wrong before. I'm not sure that the Tennis Channel will stand by him either, but again, the same rider applies.
Fascinating, incidentally, that John Wertheim, who is somebody who's worked with him for 20 years and broadcast with him on Tennis Channel, wrote a really interesting piece on the Sports Illustrated website, kind of like an imaginary address to Justin Gimelstob if he was his boss, and effectively said, look, I'm not going to stand you down, you're going to stand yourself down. And he made the point of tennis having had enough of him, and the damage that he was doing to it.
At the moment, I've heard absolutely nothing to suggest that he is interested in doing that or considering it. I mean, maybe he'll move his position if people start saying that they won't vote for him. I don't think that will happen, but I do think that that was a fine piece from John. And I think some people have been criticising him for not going further, but you've got to understand that they are colleagues in a sense, and his hands are a little bit tied, and he's been upfront, John, I mean, about the position he's in with regards to having the same employers. And I think within the constraints he was working with, he went a long way and put himself on the line, and I have a lot of respect for that.
What do you think, Catherine?
Oh, crikey. I mean, I think the nature of the statements that have been made, even the people that are prepared to speak out against him, the sort of relative to our feelings, you know, those statements feel extremely cautious and watered down, you know, even the ones that speak out against him. And I think that's an indicator of the power and influence that this guy has in the sport. You can't underestimate that. Everyone's terrified of saying the wrong thing, of being sued by him, of you know, it is a plausible scenario that he remains in a position of power in tennis to some degree. You know, in that New York Times article, the most recent one, he being, as I see it, a deluded narcissist, he sees this as an opportunity for his proudest and greatest ever achievement,
i.e. the
redemption story.
Yeah, he says, I wouldn't be the first person who's had a major issue, extenuating circumstances, and ascended to tremendous positions of responsibility, power, and leadership. I could turn it around, and I think that would be one of my greatest, most proud accomplishments.
That is how he views this situation. And as much as I think to us, I don't want to speak for everyone else, but I think we're broadly on the same page, I think it's ludicrous that we're even having these conversations. In any other corporate environment, this would be cut and dry. You know, extraordinary measures would be being put in place. We wouldn't be waiting for May the 14th for a scheduled meeting. I'm horrified to discover there isn't some kind of formal process that's automatically triggered in scenarios like this.
Well, everybody's been handing it around, haven't they?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the official bodies, actually, and it should be said here, Wimbledon were the first ones to make a statement on this subject and to make their views known in the way that they are able. What was the actual statement that they put out?
Wimbledon have put out a statement saying the AELTC can confirm that Justin Gimelstob has not and will not be invited to participate in the invitational events or to attend the Royal Box at the Championships in 2019. That's probably the strongest of the... Well, the FFT hasn't put out a statement. It's the strongest of the three, I would say. USTA have postponed making any kind of decision. They've said... they followed the news closely, assessing the situation, and will make a decision regarding Mr. Gimelstob's access to the 2019 US Open closer to the tournament. Tennis Australia's statement is particularly weak, in my view. Positions of leadership come with higher levels of expectations and accountability. The privilege to being in, I mean, also grammatically incorrect, but so anything else. The privilege to being in a position of authority requires behaviour that sets a standard and a good example. So a completely sort of detached statement about things associated with leadership and authority. They say, we acknowledge and support that the future of the Americas representative on the Player Council is a decision for the ATP, its membership, and ultimately the Player Council.
I mean, I should say, none of these organisations came out with these statements
proactively. Yeah.
I mean, they were chased.
Again,
I'm still chasing the FFT to see what their position is.
More indications that everybody is still nervous despite this of pissing this guy off.
Well, I have
and
to
that
say,
we're in a day, you know, that what does it take?
Those quotes,
what does it take?
Those quotes from Justin Gummelstaub in the New York Times about it being his opportunity and maybe his greatest achievement to come back from this are probably the ones that anger me the most. Because it's not about you, mate. It's not about you. It's not. This isn't your redemption we're looking at here. This is about you not having a position in this sport that you have tainted the way you have with your behaviour. And it's not the first time. Let's go back 11 years to the comments that he said on a radio show about female players, which were appalling at the time, which resulted in a grovelling apology from him. It was a brilliant apology, brilliantly well written. We all believed it. Well, you know, you could have believed it.
Well, he's obviously being a clever guy. I mean, there's no doubting that.
And it got him out of it because he was only a short time into his period on the ATP board at that point. And I think if that had happened today, without any of these other conditions, I think just times have changed a little. I don't think that he would be able to carry on having said those things.
I think that's optimistic personally, but...
Well, okay, I do feel things have moved. I don't think so. Things would have been accepted the way, or his apology would have been accepted in the way it was.
An incident on a paddle court last year reportedly made homophobic comments and threatened an opponent with violence. You know, I mean,
should say reportedly, like, as you said.
I did say reportedly.
Well, that's it. There've been these allegations in the past. This is now concrete. This is now.
Yeah, I mean, look, this
changes things.
In all honesty, I mean, I've been in tennis 10, 12 years. He's not somebody I've ever. I mean, I've not had dealings with him. It's not something, you know, I've got no concrete personal anecdotal evidence of him being appalling. I've never felt comfortable around him. I've always wanted to keep my distance, you know. I'm a very wafty liberal when it comes to, well, pretty much everything, but I think there are plenty of people that haven't committed any criminal offences that are appalling and probably deserve a great deal of comeuppance, and I think there are plenty of people that have committed criminal offences that I would support and consider to be good human beings in spite of that, you know. And I also believe in the Johnny Cash thing of you can support the criminal without supporting the crime, you know. I don't see criminality as a cut and dry black and white way of judging someone's character. However, I see absolutely no mitigation for Justin Gimelstob. I see no, there is nothing about him, no anecdotal evidence, no personal experience, no nothing that prods at any of my lefty liberal instincts re-criminality. Every fibre of my being says this guy is bad, you know, rotten. Make his potential, the fact that his future involvement in the governance of the sport is even up for discussion makes me feel ashamed of this sport. And I'm a bit bereft, really. I'm a bit bereft about the whole thing. And on the subject, I agree with you. Those comments were the ones among a sea of anger-inducing comments. Those were the ones that got to me the worst, because aside from anything else, you know, come back to the same point we made about Sharapova, to even contemplate any kind of redemption, you have to be seeking redemption. You have to front up to what you've done for anyone to even contemplate offering you redemption.
I mean, there are people like Dan Cahill have said there is good in him. I do know one or two
very few people are universally good or universally bad.
Yeah. Should we broaden it out a little bit to the way that he's influenced tennis politics? Because there's an interesting quote in that New York Times piece where he talks about what he's brought to the table. Maybe I could ask Matt to just locate that point about how he felt he'd outmaneuvered the tournament.
Also very proudly talks about only getting 2 hours sleep a night.
Well, we're looking for that. But the point, when I was reading John's piece, which I did, as I say, I did feel had a lot of strong argument in it, John Wertheim, I had a sort of epiphany about the way that he divides people. Even Gimelstob himself, weirdly, said to TMZ, didn't he, I'm polarising. Right at the beginning of this argument with the guy that he's been found guilty of beating up, he said to him, "You're either with the Gimelstorbs or the Synots." The Synot being the family of his estranged wife. You know, everything is about adversarial confrontation. This is the way that he's handled the politics of the ATP. Have you got it, Matt?
Yeah, so he says, "This sounds horrible, but I'm very good at what I do, and that upsets people in our structure. The players know how good I am, especially in terms of improving prize money for them, and that pisses off the tournaments. It annoys them that, even in a compromised state, I've been able to outwit, outmaneuver, outstrategize, and outmobilize them."
So he's sitting on a board which consists of three tournament representatives.
Thinks a lot of himself, doesn't he?
And three player representatives, and he thinks this is something to celebrate. So for Justin Gimelstob, it seems that everything is a zero-sum game. If somebody wins, somebody's got to lose. And that is not how tennis should be. And if you actually, I'd like to refer you to your very interesting interview with Janko Tipsarevic and the way that he talked about the players have to believe that it's possible to move the French Open to Rome, to move the Australian Open to Beijing, and to move Wimbledon to Abu Dhabi. In other words, the players... Tipsarevic is close to Novak Djokovic. He's close to this wave of confrontational player politics that has been, in my opinion, fueled by Justin Gimelstob. They want to confront the tournaments. They want to say, "You've got to pay us more. We're going to go on strike." And this is the way that he's toxified the entire politics of the sport. And it's just... I agree that the whole inability of tennis to turn around and make a clear statement at this point makes it look small and shabby. But it also, he's also jamming up the works at a time when, A, the men's tour is coming to an end of stability in the sense of having these huge heroes who are, like it or not, not going to be around for many more years. And B, the slams are... They may not be paying the players the 50% of their revenues they want, but it's unbelievable what they are doing. I mean, Wimbledon bought the golf club, right? The French Open is building a new stadium. It's moving into the next door gardens. The amount of money that is being spent on improving the fan experience, on boosting tennis right now, it is mind-boggling. And the slams have never been better or stronger. And this is the one positive about tennis right now, is that as somebody who covers the sport, you know, I went from the US Open, which finished with the Serena meltdown, which was on all the front pages, straight into the Australian Open, which began with Andy Murray talking about potential retirement, all the front pages. This sport, the slams, it's not just those events, all the stories around them, whether it be, you know, the change of shirt that caused the fuss at the US Open, they are massive crossover stories. Tennis has never been stronger in those weeks, and the players are now saying, "We don't like this, you know, we think we should be confronting you and saying that we're not getting our piece of the pie because you're having all the fun." Now, okay, I've moved away from Justin Gimelstob as an individual, but this inability to see the big picture and to see that tennis is not a zero-sum game, I think is directly his responsibility.
And it's also, it is not black and white. You can exert some pressure and do some negotiating, but what I've discovered over the course of my career is that there's different ways to negotiate. You don't just have to hammer somebody into the ground in the way that Justin Gimelstob talks about in those quotes. And what really winds me up is that he thinks that only he could do that. And therefore his position should be, he should be bulletproof as a result of it.
But why would you do that in the first place? It's actually a terrible way to negotiate.
And one of the things that I said to Vasek Pospisil is, you don't need this guy. My point is, yes, he might have done a good job for you, as you it's fair to acknowledge somebody who you think has done a good job for you. But are you telling me he is the only person who could negotiate a good deal for you? Because I do not believe that. Are you telling me, Tennis Channel, that he's the only commentator that is good enough for you? I don't believe that. I'm sure he's very good. But you can get a good one that hasn't got something like this next to their name. And same for the players. There's different types of leadership. I was at the Sport Industry Awards the other day, and Gareth Southgate came onto the stage, the England football manager, and he is a victory for decency of, yes, having brains, but finding a way to lead that doesn't involve grabbing people by the scruff of the neck and scaring them into submission and getting them to do what
what they want just by being adversarial. He has people follow him in a way that doesn't make people feel like dirt.
But it's so backwards, isn't it, that the players might be the ones who are able to decide on Justin Gimelstob's future. If he's so good at helping them, then why are they the ones who have got the power to keep him in the job? Because obviously some of them are going to be swayed to support him because of what he's done for them. He's been convicted in a court of law. Why do we need Kevin Anderson to decide, or Novak Djokovic or Bruno Suarez, the people on the council?
It needs redefining, doesn't it? There needs to be something in their rules that enables them to say, actually, if you behave like that, you can't serve on this.
Well, he's a schemer, isn't it? And he's got all these people in place who support him, David Edges. So he's kind of thinking that he's untouchable in that way because of the processes in place. For him to be removed would be the people who support him to vote him out.
But aren't the processes there? I mean, it should be a straightforward decision for the people on the board and for the people on the
council. But there's so much conflict of interest,
there's two people on the boards that are not him.
Yeah, I mean, in any
corporate environment,
on the players'
board, and one of them is his best mate.
John Isner would have been required in the equivalent scenario in a Fortune 500 company, whatever, in the regular corporate world that isn't this confused, bizarre world of tennis, John Isner would have been required to recuse himself from that board. He wouldn't have a vote. It is utterly ludicrous that John Isner is able to vote on May the 14th. I mean, it's pretty ludicrous that we're talking about May the 14th, as Simon said, but I think the combined points that you've all made there are really powerful, actually. It doesn't have to be this way. He is, not single-handedly, but as I say, I mean, he's been, I think, the single biggest mastermind of a thoroughly rotten and toxic setup in the atmosphere, in the governance of the sport. I think there's an element of sort of Stockholm syndrome, right? He's got all these people hoodwinked into, he's sort of their abuser, and yet they all think, we need him, you know, you only need him because if the parameters, within the parameters with which he has set, remove him and you can reset the parameters and you therefore don't need him anymore. And it's, you know, and I think the whole of men's tennis has a bit of a stench of toxic masculinity about it. You know, these little issues don't exist in a vacuum. You know, the article that Charlie Eccleshare wrote about the lack of male players who have come out as gay on the men's tour, the fact that the equal prize money debate is raging again in 2019 on the men's tour. There is a stench of toxic masculinity, and he, Justin Gimelstob, is a beacon of that, an absolute beacon, and a beacon with an extraordinary amount of power, and that situation is unreal, really.
He does have rivals now for that role.
Yeah.
Two people have put their hand in the air officially now. Mm. The former top 10 player Tim Mayotte, and it needs to be an American, doesn't it, for the Americas region, or it could be Danny Valverde, who is somebody else who's been talked about in those terms as potentially a candidate as well. He's from Venezuela, although I did ask him and he said he hasn't decided yet. Brad Gilbert is another one who has also put himself forward. Brad, who actually has some history with Gimelstob as well. I was reading a piece on Sports Illustrated website from 21 years ago in which Brad Gilbert and Justin Gimelstob's late father fell out over various issues back then. Obviously, you know, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because Brad hasn't coached for a while. He's been a commentator. He's a former player. Tim Mayotte has not been a hugely visible person, but I think it's quite a positive that two people have come forward and decided that they want to take this on.
Yeah, Mike Dixon reported on Friday that the half a dozen candidates were expected to stand, but I mean, I come back to this point that if he is dislodged, let's say, by an alternative candidate on May the 14th, he's still going to serve out the rest of 2019.
That cannot happen. I mean,
if the orthodox processes of the ATP are followed. I mean, I still think that the processes of removal are fairly straightforward. It's the people who are not triggering them who are more at fault. There's a slight side argument about the fact that when you elect a tournament representative, the 60-odd tournament directors all vote, whereas when you elect a player representative, only the 10 people on the player council vote. That probably is something that should be changed, because what you do get in a lot of political situations is a lot of people who are very apathetic, don't know what's going on, don't really take the time to inform themselves, and a few zealots who then, if they have a view which could necessarily be a bit of a silo, if you like, they are engaging with themselves and reaffirming their own bias, then they can really drive the decision making off course, and that's what, in my opinion, is happening here. So I think the only thing I'd say about the Constitution, apart from the bigger issues about that board being three representatives of tournaments and players, which is complicated already, is that all the players should be voting for that player representative when they come up for re-election, not just the player council.
So your view is the most likely scenario here is that this will be resolved before we get to May the 14th, and actually he won't be on that.
I think there are going to be votes, because the two processes which I'm talking about will be invoked before then. I don't know quite when, I don't know what the results will be, but I just still cling to this perhaps naive belief that people are going to see sense and are going to vote him off.
What would that mean for Chris Commode, of whom his tenure was not renewed? It's not going to be renewed at the end of the year.
Second referendum.
I mean, yeah. Could he actually end up carrying on?
I've heard one very powerful player in all this say outright to me that they want that to be overturned, and they want, for stability's sake, Chris to be put back, as it were, in the top job. Whether it can happen, it's all about numbers, really, and whether he would have enough support. I think it's possible, but I mean, there's so many hoops to get through before we even reach that point.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So that's Justin Gilmour-Stubb. Can we talk about tennis now? Hold on a minute. I'm looking at Matt's agenda here, and we've actually got to talk about some more politics because Marco...
Look at Simon's weary face.
Marco, more the listeners I feel for.
Marco Trungoliti, the Argentine, you may remember, who drove to Paris from Barcelona with his grandma in the car last year at the French Open because he wanted to take advantage of a lucky loser position, and he won a round, as you say. Well, he's been in the news for some rather more... disturbing reasons. He's given an interview about the match fixing stories that have been going around. He'd been a key witness in a match fixing probe that snared three fellow Argentines, including the number 84 Nicolas Kicker, testifying, even though he knew that there would be a backlash, and he said the players no longer talk to him, and he says the tennis administrators and anti-corruption investigators haven't defended him either. He says he feels used. It's a tough one, isn't it? Because anybody who is prepared to put themselves on the line the way he has and actually come out and give information, I suppose, can make themselves a target.
Well, it's another grim old story, isn't it? Only adding to the sort of head-in-hands state of tennis in 2019 administratively, that somebody should have come out with evidence to the TIU and then, A, for that to have been revealed, and B, for him to have been treated with the cold shoulder by the rest of the locker room. I mean, it's pretty damn depressing. I kind of missed the original story. I mean, I asked somebody about it, and they said, oh, there was a initial reveal on this was in February. I don't know if I was lying in a darkened room after the Australian Open. And then the next I knew of it was the AP interview with him, and I was like, wow, that's a pretty good story. And actually, we haven't run anything about it because it's like, which day do you do it? There's no real peg for it, but it is a really interesting story, and we should probably be getting onto it somehow.
Yeah. Sergei Stakhovsky, a council member, weighed in on Twitter. Thin line between whistleblower and snitch. All depends who is the judge, he said, which he was taken to task on. I mean, he subsequently tried to...
By you, David. Taken to task on by you.
Well, yeah. By quite a few people.
By quite a few people. I mean,
unfailingly attempting to defeat internet stupid despite my urgings.
He's tried to walk away from the... Certainly the inference I took from those words, I took particular offence to the word snitch being used as a description of somebody like Trungoliti, who is, well, doing what we hope players that are approached are prepared to do. And I still haven't completely got to the bottom of what Stakhovsky was trying to say.
Was there an inference there that Trungoliti might have not been 100% on the side of the angels? I read that into some of his tweets.
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, he told me to go and read a piece that I think he's tweeted, which I will go and read, Sergei, if you're listening,
and
I'll think about it.
Look, everyone's entitled to their opinion. Everyone apparently is entitled to have put that opinion on the internet. But not all opinions are equal. And none of what he says stands up to any scrutiny at all, any logical... or empirical scrutiny. So
I feel like we've said this a few times in this podcast.
Yeah, like I just don't. I mean, we've aired his views.
I don't really want to waste my breath on Sergei Stakhovsky. Yeah.
I mean, just doesn't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. I don't find what he has to say on it significant. He's had his say. If you want to take notice of that, you're welcome to.
Fair enough.
I don't see any significance in it at all, apart from the fact he's on the bloomin' player council. And
we live in a world where the 25 million inquiry into match fixing has instructed the ITF that they should be discontinuing live streaming of odds on 15k tournaments, which is still continuing. I mean, this is tennis in 2019. It's alarming. I mean, the sport, like, as I say, it's got loads going for it in 2019. Absolutely fantastic stuff happening on the court, behind the scenes. The ATP seemed to me to be the least kind of chaotic and accident-prone body until this year. And now it's like, it's hold my beer.
Playing catch-up.
Other stuff that's happened, the ATP Finals is moving from London. After the next couple of years, it'll be in the O2 in London for 2019-2020, and then it is moving to Turin for 5 years in Italy's largest sporting indoor arena, the Pala Alpitour Stadium, with record prize money of $14.5 million. $500,000 more than they announced for the WTA finals in Shenzhen.
And Russell Fuller of BBC Radio reported, and that is now being widely reported, that a motivation for the move was the guaranteed purse that would equal and better that of the WTA finals, which made me laugh out loud while I was making my coffee in the kitchen. I just found that very amusing.
Yes.
One instance of inequality in favour of men, and it had to be rectified instantly.
Yeah, I mean, it's I said on Twitter, sad news, to which I got a lot of people saying, not sad news at all, it was about time it moved. I mean, let's see, it's fair enough to move it for sure. It's been in London for 12 years, the Turin city authorities have promised to underwrite the tournament so that it's guaranteed to make money for the ATP, so fair enough. But it's still sad, you know, for the British point of view, because it's a big tournament and it was doing a good job of presenting a different look for a sport which, to most floating voters, is all about the grass court season.
Apparently interest from the Laver Cup in sort of taking up that the venue and that sort of, I guess, trying to claim the crowd, the ticket buyers for that event, trying to sort of...
That would do well, wouldn't it, actually?
I'm not expressing that very well, but you know what I mean.
Although it would go against their mantra of holding the Laver Cup in cities where they don't have tennis already.
Prague has tennis already, doesn't it?
Not like that, though, does it? I mean, it has a relatively minor event on the WTA circuit.
And that was a huge week for AEG, who own the O2, to have 35,000 people coming through the doors of the shopping areas, the restaurants around the dome. You know, that was their biggest week of the year. So, obviously, the Labour Cup would be a three-day event.
Mm.
It wouldn't replace it, but I can see that there'd be a lot of motivation for them to do it. It would make an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, you've sort of got a ready-made ticket-buying public, really, if you can market it in the right way.
People used to come from Switzerland, didn't they, for the Roger and Stan factor.
Yeah, it was like a pilgrimage, wasn't it?
And there was a famous year, wasn't there, when Andy came back having won... Was it 2012? He came back, he'd won the US Open, his first match on British soil, against Roger, and he was like the second favourite with the crowd. He must have wondered what he had to do.
Yeah. David Haggerty is seeking re-election as the ITF president, reports Chris Clary. No great surprise there. And just a few tennis results for those of you that actually want to hear about tennis. Barcelona was won by Dominic Thiem. Correct prediction by Catherine Whittaker that he would beat Rafael Nadal in the semi-finals. Well done with that. And we had over 800 votes in our prediction for that particular match. 50-50 exactly, which I found really interesting.
See the Telegraph's interview with Dominic Thiem published on Wednesday, last week.
What did he say?
Tuesday.
What was the gist of what he said?
He said he loves football, he's got his own team, and he also split up with Gunther because...
Is it the Dominic Thiem team?
He split with Gunther because it was like a marriage and he was fed up with hearing the same thing 25 times a day. And he's in favour of equal pay because he sees how hard his girlfriend, Kiki Mladenovic, works in practice and on the court.
What did you think of him as a bloke?
Oh, what a nice bloke. I mean, he is underreported. He's under noticed because he's such a nice bloke, and he's not a very complicated bloke. I mean, he's quite bright. He just loves his tennis. He loves his sport. He loves his girlfriend, and he gets on with it. And he's a fantastic player. And it's kind of hard to find angles on him because he's just a really decent human being. But I mean, crucially, very humble. And actually, I was walking along Monte Carlo with him and people coming up for photos and stuff. I mean, he was absolutely charming.
Chelsea fan, though. If you're looking for an angle, a negative one, there you go.
Rafael Nadal, how worried should Nadal fans be right now? I offered them one coin, my coin, my special... predictions coin.
He usually gets a coin out on the table at this point. Got one?
I'm out of coins.
Just for the sake of sound effects.
To put on the winner of the French Open men's singles champion, and 55% have said they'd still go Nadal.
Hang on, is it Nadal versus another individual, or is it Nadal or
against
the rest of the field?
It's Nadal or somebody else. anyone else.
See, I think Nadal is the most likely individual to win the French Open, but at the moment I'd lean towards taking the field.
Agree.
So you're picking Nadal to win it then?
Versus any other individual. If you asked me to put percentages on each individual French Open contender, I would have Nadal as the greatest single percentage. But if you offered me Nadal or the field, just at the moment I'd go field.
But you're picking Nadal.
And also the French Open isn't next week.
Didn't he say after Barcelona, I feel a lot better about myself?
Yeah, he said after Monte Carlo, he said, probably the worst clay court match I played in 14 years. And after Barcelona, he said, I'm feeling better, I've made some improvements.
Because remember that his default mechanism is to say, oh, I'm not feeling great, you know, my knees are hurting. Well, not actually, to imply that he's not quite physically at his peak.
And there were videos of him shaking out his wrist. And shaking his head while he was doing it in practice.
So for him to say I'm feeling positive, in a way that kind of hit home with me. I haven't actually seen the whole interview, but that made me think, if he's feeling like he's building, then
he was pretty roundly beaten by Dominic Thiem. He's got a lot of building to do. It wasn't best of five. But he was...
Didn't have a break point, did he?
Pretty roundly beaten.
Only in the final game.
Okay. Yeah, Thiem believes now. Thiem believes he can beat Rafael Nadal in any context. And for me, that's really significant. He doesn't walk out on the court thinking, I've got to absolutely redline my game to have a chance anymore. He goes out on the court thinking, my game's good enough. Mm. And mentally, for me, that's significant. Because I think the game has just about been there. But then, you know, I think... French Open final last year that he might have been trying to convince his brain that he believed, but none of the cells in his body actually believed.
But Rafa had won all but one of his clay court matches, hadn't he? He'd lost to him in Madrid.
He lost to Thiem in Madrid last year and Rome the year before.
So this is a different scenario this year, isn't it? But Thiem is clearly a better player. And there's only two guys on the tour who've won more than one title. Roger and Dominic Thiem. He's won a hard court Masters event. He's finally got rid of Günter Breznik, who he kind of admitted to me had been holding him back. We didn't put it in that in so many words, but you could tell that was what he was feeling. He's got Nicolas Massou in. He's clearly feeling good about himself. I mean, he's really in a good place.
And his tennis,
personally, professionally,
his tennis against Nadal just feels more sustainable, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like,
he's not having to just completely hit Nadal off the court. He's kind of playing his own clay court tennis. Like, the way to beat Nadal has always been kind of shorten points and just, or the Novak Djokovic mold of use your backhand to play into Nadal's forehand corner, but no one else can do that apart from Djokovic. Thiem's able to play his own clay court game and it'd be good enough at the moment to beat Nadal. But
over three sets. That's the
big
asterisk.
You know, the Barcelona court has Nadal's name officially, but really his court
is weird, isn't it?
Philippe Chatrier.
Could they not have waited just a few years to do that? I feel sorry for all his opponents walking out onto the Rafael Nadal court to play Rafael Nadal. It's ludicrous.
We haven't mentioned the bloke who won the last three slams.
Oh yeah, Novak Djokovic.
Well, you didn't mention him in dispatches there, but you didn't
mention
him as like a front runner for the French Open, which surely he must be.
I've still got him as my favourite.
What? Yeah. Ahead of Nadal?
Yeah, I told you the Australian Open. I'm picking Djokovic to win it.
He's not done anything since the Australian Open.
I'm picking him to win it.
It just doesn't feel like one of those years where Nadal sets the tone with his clay court form right at the start, and it kind of feels obvious that he's going to win. But I think Nadal, Thiem and Djokovic, because of what he's done in the slams, would be...
It's hard to see anyone else winning it.
It's hard to see anyone else.
It's from those three, isn't it?
Yeah.
We haven't seen Roger Federer on clay yet. Fabio Fognini, anyone?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was good.
The chances of him keeping his head together over seven best of five matches, but
he's probably still partying in Monte Carlo, isn't he?
I mean, he can be a bit objectionable, notably his rant at the umpire when he was deeply misogynist. Was it last year? But just to watch him,
it's a joy,
lovely
isn't
to
it?
Watch, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
A few other results in Budapest. Matteo Berrettini beat Filip Krajinovic to win the title. Ken and Neil Skupski won the doubles. Incidentally, Jay Clark won a challenger the week before. I forgot to mention that last week, so well done, Jay.
Liam Brody, runner-up in a challenger last night.
Yeah. Jamie Murray was in the doubles final with Bruno Suarez in Barcelona. They lost out there. Stuttgart, Petra Kvitova beat Annette Kontaveit. I'm afraid we're not going to talk about that as much as we should be talking about it because we've had so much other stuff to talk about. But that is Kvitova, the first woman to win multiple titles this year. There had been 18 winners in 18 events up until that point. So she's now top in the race to Shenzhen, the tour finals. Naomi Osaka kept her world number one ranking there by reaching the semis. This was her first quarterfinals and semis on clay.
It feels weird to hear the race to Shenzhen, but
yeah. But retired ahead of the semi final with an abdominal injury.
Right. Oh, crikey. Yes, that's right, against Kontaveit, wasn't it?
Beat Shea.
Yes. So that's what's happened. Petra Martic has beaten Marketa Vondrousova as well in Istanbul.
Vondrousova's having a year, isn't she?
Yeah. This week we've got Estoril, Munich, Prague and Rabat. Just a final word on Munich because Alexander Zverev is playing there. We talked about his, frankly, pretty appalling form this year. He gave a roundtable interview with the German media over in Munich, and I haven't read all of it, but I've seen some bullet points translated, which talked about how his dad is unwell. It said he's broken up with his girlfriend, and we know that he's no longer represented by his agent, Patricio Appé. I think that's probably been pretty messy as well. It sounds like he's not having the best of times just generally in his life, and I wonder whether that is contributing certainly to his struggles on the court. We don't know, but I wanted to say it.
Well, the fact that he's talking about all of that in an interview with tennis journalists suggests, I mean, he's in a tricky spot, isn't he? He got a hard time from me for talking about his cold and that, and implying that was a factor in some of his recent defeats. So it's a fine line between excuse making and just really pleasing
candor.
Candidness. And I, for me, this is, I'm pleased that he's, we expect them to be robots and they're not robots.
Yeah, good for him. I mean, speaking as a reporter, he's really somebody whose press conferences you want to go to, because I mean, there is often something in there that's for you to get your teeth into, and he's an interesting, bright, full of character. Not everyone likes him. You know, it's good to have people who are a little bit Marmite, and long may he continue to be successful.
And he's in this kind of tricky situation because with all that going on, you might think he needs kind of a little break from it, but he said himself he needs to play matches in order to get his form, and he went to Marrakesh, didn't he? Took a wild card into Barcelona. He's playing Munich. He's basically playing every week you can on the clay. And yet he's in this kind of horrible loop of not playing very well and losing and therefore not getting the matches he needs. Difficult time for him.
It is. Right. I think that's about all we've got time for in this edition of the Tennis Podcast. We were intending, as we mentioned last week, to talk about the Janko Tipsarevic interview, to get Catherine's views on it, to talk about his comments to do with prize money, and particularly those have resurfaced this week because we had the Stuttgart and Barcelona prize money differentials, pretty drastic ones as well. We haven't really got time for it this week. We will come back to it, do it in depth, but for now, Simon, thank you for your company.
Thanks for having me.
It's been lovely to have you here. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
For joining us here on the Tennis Podcast. As always, in conjunction with The Telegraph, we're executive produced by tennisballs.com. We are represented by our mascot, Rio with a Y, and we will be back next week. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.